This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Icecapades, a memoir of fast living and tough hockey. This is the author, Sean Avery. To the sixth grade kid who hates sitting still. To the high school junior bored to death by class. To the new intern on Broadway. Every now and then, say what the fuck. What the fuck gives you freedom? Freedom brings opportunity. Opportunity makes your future. What the fuck? If you can't say it, you can't do it. Miles Dalby, Risky Business, 1983. Prologue. I loved playing hockey. More than anything, really, from the age of five, when I first saw Hockey Night in Canada on TV. I knew at that moment that I wanted to wear an NHL jersey and have thousands of fans cheer for me. But if you're here for stories of me growing up under starry winter skies playing hockey on frozen ponds with a hot chocolate chaser, you're in the wrong place. I played in the NHL for 13 seasons, and I played to win. I wanted to be great. I mean, why do anything if you don't want to be great? But I didn't lie awake at night, tossing and turning, hoping that one day I'd be in the Hall of Fame. I just wanted to get everything I could out of the game. Sure, I was playing for the money, just like everyone else. But I was also playing for the opportunities. A lot of doors open for millionaire pro athletes, though most guys never look to see what's behind them. Don't get me wrong, I also played for fun. No one can say that a Gordie Howe hat trick, goal, assist, fight, doesn't put you in a great mood. One of the few improvements I can think of is the Sean Avery hat trick. Playing a great game, going to a club afterward and getting wasted, then taking a supermodel home for a nightcap that lasts till sunrise. That doesn't sound so terrible, does it? People have offered up some pretty strong opinions about me over the years. It's hard for me to say whether they're fair or not. No one is going to care about my self-justifications anyway. I'm certainly not going to claim to be perfect. I'm not even going to claim to be a good guy. It's not my business to tell anyone what to think of me. I will say this, though. The guy you may have seen on the ice, the hate-filled wrecking ball, that's not exactly who I am. It's probably ridiculous to think we can know anyone from the way they play a game on TV. And in my case, I played to the camera, and the crowd, and the press box. I made sure everyone was watching. That wasn't me being myself. That was me being who everyone thought I was. I loved having the bullseye on my back. Anyone who thought they were hurting my feelings by talking about me had me all wrong. So did every guy who got red in the face and tried to take my head off. If someone was writing about me or taking runs at me, I was winning. I was making my team better. Yes, that's my job. But I was also making myself richer and more famous. Name me a more famous third liner in NHL history. Not that it was all an act. Scoring a goal in Madison Square Garden is a feeling I think anyone would enjoy. I have to say, though, I enjoyed kicking the shit out of Mike Richards at center ice at Madison Square Garden even more. That may sound awful, but trust me, it was fun. I also did quite a lot of other things, and if I had the chance to do them all again, I'd take it. And yes, I missed the game since I walked away from it. I miss the roar of the crowd. I miss the sheer speed of life. There are some days when I feel like nothing will ever be that good again. But those days are fewer and farther between now. So don't expect me to get nostalgic about how I miss hanging out with the guys in the dressing room. I met some great guys over the years, but I also wasted a lot of time on planes and buses with some truly boring people. And even more time playing by other people's rules. I don't miss that at all. I'm not 100% sure what motivated me. And you need plenty of motivation to be one of the fittest guys in one of the toughest leagues in the world. I do know one thing, though. If you tell me I can't do something, I can pretty much guarantee I'll do it. So thanks, by the way, to all the people who told me I'd never make it. Without you, it's entirely possible I might never have put in the hours of work it took to play in the NHL. Maybe you thought I didn't play the game the right way, but try to imagine having 20,000 people chanting your name after you've scored a goal, won a fight, or taken down the best guy on the other team, and then tell me you'd act any differently. On the other hand, I'd be almost as happy having 20,000 people absolutely hating me. Hello, Philadelphia. I'd much rather be hated than ignored. Sometimes getting a rise out of the crowd was a way to entertain myself. The NHL season is long, and there are some nights when it's hard to skate like nothing else matters. Because other things start to matter, and you can't win all 82 games. So sometimes I went out and turned the world upside down just to get through the game. Other guys took drugs. Once upon a time, the great Steve Yzerman told me that I should think about shutting up and just playing hockey. He said I had the talent, and that was good enough. And who wouldn't be flattered by having a Hall of Famer like Stevie Y tell you that? I didn't take Steve's advice because talent wasn't enough for me. I needed the adrenaline that constant conflict, and sometimes chaos, gave me. I went on a 13-season tear by playing the game by my own rules and learning more and more about who I was. Along the way, I met so many interesting people and forged so many life-changing relationships that I think I might have had more fun than any guy who ever played in the NHL. Chapter 1. Last Chance. I wanted this since I was 5 years old. I'm now 21, and time is running out. Of course, looking back, I realized I had lots of time. But in September 2001, all I knew was that playing the game I loved more than anything in the NHL was the only option. There was no plan B. My heart is pounding. I am here to earn a spot on the Detroit Red Wings of the National Hockey League. The fact that people are already talking about this as one of the best teams in history isn't going to make things any easier. I'm going to have to take a job away from someone the Red Wings actually want on the roster. And they've already told me in several ways that they don't want me. This is my third crack at making the NHL. I've already played 2 seasons in the minors. Every year, a new bunch of rookies shows up, diminishing my odds. When I look around at the guys in camp, or when lying awake in bed last night, I have to ask whether I am good enough. I'm not an idiot. I know most people would say no. The Red Wings already said no. I had been good enough once. As a kid, I played for an all-Ontario rep team. By the way, that's a big deal. In my last year of junior hockey, I had 28 goals and 56 assists for 85 points in 55 games. To put it in perspective, my fellow OHL player Jason Spezza had 36 goals and 50 assists and 86 points for the Windsor Spitfires in his best junior season. Spezza was chosen second overall in the first round of the 2001 NHL entry draft. He was beaten out by Ilya Kovalchuk, who was drafted first and tore up the NHL for a while before walking away from $77 million and 12 years on his contract with New Jersey to play in Russia. Being drafted by the NHL doesn't guarantee anything. I know this too well, as I wasn't drafted at all. On draft day in 2001, part of me believed that there was at least one NHL general manager out there who would see what I could bring to a team. And another part of me believed that getting drafted was too good to be true. I wasn't going to sit by the phone. I spent draft day at a pool party. When I came home, neither of my parents even mentioned the draft, and I didn't ask if anyone had called. It was as if we had all moved on to the next plan of attack. I'd go to training camp as a free agent. But still, it hurt. No one wanted me. Nearly 300 guys were taken, and not one GM wanted to use a 9th-round pick on me. Well, I know why. The knock on me was that I was a bad teammate. Did this mean that I stole other players' girlfriends? That I was an arrogant puck hog? That I put Tiger Bomb in guys' jock straps and thought it was the funniest thing ever when they tried to extinguish the 3-alarm fire burning up the family jewels? No, none of the above. What it meant was that I played to win on every shift, and some other players don't see the game that way. So I would let them know that they could do better. Since no one likes to be called out for dogging it, the rap landed on me that I was bad in the room, which in hockey speak means you're not one of the guys. Maybe it's the same in other sports, but in hockey, being one of the guys goes a long way. What it won't do, though, is win you a puck battle in the corner, and it's certainly not going to win you a fight. So if I wasn't going to make it as everyone's best friend and all-around good guy, well, I'd have to make it as the opposite. I did have one friend in Detroit, though. I knew Chris Draper from growing up in the same town that he did, Scarborough, Ontario, which is part of Toronto, but so far from the city center that it's known as Scarberia. In 1997-98, when Draper was then in his 5th season with the Red Wings, the one in which he'd win the 2nd of his 4 Stanley Cups, we worked out at the same gym. I was playing for the Ontario under-17 team, which fell under the umbrella of the Canadian National Hockey Program. So, as elite players, we trained at the same facility as pros like Drapes. He had success, money, and a lovely wife. He was a good husband, and he took care of everyone around him. He was close with his dad, he had friends, and when he let loose, he could put any frat boy to shame. He was the best guy. Drapes also had the Red Wing workout gear, which was sponsored by Nike and which was very foreign to a Canadian kid. We had Bauer, and that was it. Draper would show up in this gear and hand it out to guys like me. I saw how organized and disciplined and dedicated he was. And at that moment, I was the most in awe of anyone that I had ever been. Draper was physically a specimen. He was not big, and that was important because neither was I. He was 5'9", and some days when he was feeling supreme, he was 5'10", and 180 pounds of lean, cut muscle. He was one of the first guys to make being in top shape a cool thing. Spend any time in the gym with a guy like Drapes, and all you want is to be as chiseled as he is. Drapes liked me because I pushed him hard and wanted to beat him at everything. So every day he showed up at the gym, he had a hungry dog on his ass who reminded him that I wanted to take his job. He later told me that I added years onto his career. But at that point, I was just working as hard as I could to keep up with him. One of Detroit's scouts, Joe McDonnell, helped me too. McDonnell had been a minor league defenseman who played a few games in the NHL for Vancouver and Pittsburgh. He'd moved on to coaching in the Ontario Hockey League, and he knew I could play. Mac was not a suit and tie guy. He was a player's guy, a real hockey man. He loved the game and wasn't interested in playing politics. So when he said that I had a shot in Detroit, I believed him. He wasn't the kind of guy to flatter a no-hoper. I had a reputation as bad as they come, and Mac's job was to have good judgment. In my mind, he'd put his job on the line by taking a chance on me, and I wouldn't let him down. But even with Drapes and McDonnell in my corner at that training camp in 2001, I needed to do more than just play. Everyone in camp could play hockey at an elite level. Otherwise, they wouldn't be there. And they all know me. because I played against most of them in junior. There will be times later in my career when I will most definitely wish I could take a break from my reputation. But now it's the thing that makes me stand out, and I'm going to use it to my advantage. I'm here to get noticed, and a bad reputation makes that a lot easier. I've pretty much been working on this problem of finding an advantage since I was 12 years old. That was when everyone around me seemed to have a growth spurt. And I did not. And the "you're too small" stuff really got aimed at me. That dismissal, combined with the onset of puberty, was a pretty potent motivator. So while all the other players were getting bigger, I was getting smarter. I had to find a way to stay competitive until the day when I was their size. By the way, that day never came. Hockey is a game of unwritten rules so complicated and subjective that no two people can agree on what they are. Some people call these rules the code. Other people deny that there is a code. But everybody thinks there is a right way to play hockey, especially Canadians who feel they should be able to tell everyone what the right way is, who you're allowed to hit and how hard, depending on the score, and how much time is left on the clock, and how many games are left in the season. Everyone thinks they have the algorithm to answer these questions, and they take it very seriously. They also know exactly how much you're allowed to celebrate, and even how you should dress. Personally, I don't care, but these things are important to me because they're important to other people. Break these rules and people will lose their minds. And when they lose their minds, a guy like me wins. I'm no different. If another player gets under my skin, I want to punch his face in. But if I'm chasing him around trying to hurt him, I'm not doing my job. Better to get him chasing me. And then he's not doing his job. That makes me an agitator. My template for success had three parts: identifying my opponent's best player, their tough guy, and their agitator. The best player was easy to pick out because of the way he wore his uniform or his hair. Remember Gretzky with his jersey tucked into his pants? Or Tony Amonte's flowing locks? The best player would put white tape on his stick blades, or roll his sleeves up so you could see a bit of skin between his gloves and jersey. It was all designed to say, "Look at me, I'm different because I'm better." Hockey players are trained to stick up for the guys with the soft hands. If you want to sucker the other team into a penalty, at some point you're going to have to target their leading scorer. You don't have to be a scout to spot the tough guy. A true tough guy has a kind of aura about him. Watch a bunch of dogs in the park. They all know which one not to mess with, even if he's just trotting along with his tail in the air. The thing is, teams love their tough guys. Fans love their tough guys. If you disrespect a tough guy and get away with it, the whole hockey world is off its axis. He can be counted on to take a stupid penalty. It's money in the bank. And the agitators, my species, are the most fun. You can smell their need to prove themselves. They're always small, and they always have more energy than everyone else. You could see it in warm-up, when the agitators would go harder, just excited to be there. And often they would have a black eye or stitches from bugging the wrong guy at the wrong time. Pissing off hockey players can be a dangerous line of work. Anyway, I'd identify my three targets and systematically go after them in different ways. I'd run the best player, or take a cheap shot at him during the play. A glove in the face, or a whack to the ankles, for instance. My way of saying, "Hello." Now he's unhappy, and his whole team is unhappy. You know how hockey players are always talking about going out there and having fun? Not when I'm on the ice. As for the tough guy, I'd take a wicked two-hander against the back of his legs after a whistle. No pads, right? And what could he do? Drop the gloves? Sure. If he really wanted to take a penalty when I leave mine on. Remember, my job is to piss people off. And nothing pisses off a hockey player more than a guy who turns down an invitation to dance. In other words, it was often my job not to fight. And as for the agitator, my advantage was that I was pretty much always a better player than he was. So I would get power play time, which was useful in calling out the other guy's total meathead uselessness. I would score a goal or set one up, and then let the other agitator know that he could do that too if he had the hockey goods to be out on the ice at critical times in the game. If you can agitate the agitator, you're doing all right. NHL teams actually have two training camps. A rookie camp first, followed by the main camp. Detroit's rookie camp in 2001 was like none that either players or management had ever seen before. I played like it was the Stanley Cup. By the time the main camp starts, I pretty much turned rookie camp upside down. I ran goalie Andrew Raycroft, which triggered a line brawl. It's all on the edge of out of control. But this is part of my master plan. The big club needs to realize that they need what I bring to the game. An ability to jolt a team awake, or get an opponent so mad at me that they do stupid things that cost them. The Red Wings don't have a first-round pick that year, but they have a good crop of rookies, led by this Russian kid named Pavel Datsyuk. He's insanely talented. I know he's going to make the team, so I'm not too worried about him. But his gifts piss me off just enough to motivate me to go after the guys who think they can make it just because they're there. And it works. I'm off to the main camp. The first thing that happens is that we get our envelopes with our training camp per diems. $86 a day to keep you fed and watered. The envelopes are filled not only with money, but also with meaning. The first round of cuts is in 4 days. So if the contents of your per diem envelope are significantly higher than 4 times $86, then you know you're not going anywhere. Team captain Steve Yzerman gets a per diem envelope for his entire time in camp. My per diem envelope is 4 times $86. This means that I have enough to get me to the first red and white game, which is what the Red Wings call the intra-squad game, and which could be my last chance to show management what this undrafted 21-year-old kid can do for a team on the hunt for its third Stanley Cup in 5 years. One thing I can show them is my work ethic. The NHL is becoming size-obsessed right about now, and because I'm not 6'3 and 220 pounds, I'm 5'10, 195. I had to try to compensate, which is why I always aimed to be one of the 5 fittest guys at camp. One of the conditioning things we do is the 1 mile test, which means running 4 laps of a track as fast as you can. Usually the top goal scorer of any team I've been on was at the bottom of the pile with a pretty sorry time of 17 minutes plus. So I'd go out of my way to tell the guys I was competing against that I was feeling great. So very great that I was going to break 11 minutes. I wasn't blowing smoke either. My best time was 11 minutes, 13 seconds. Back in June, I'd puked on the track running quarter miles with Chris Draper. I was dry heaving on the last 2 laps of the run, and Drape said he couldn't stop laughing and that's why I beat him. I was 21 and Drapes was 29, and on his way to hitting his prime. I don't think a hockey player hits his prime until around age 31. because that is when body and mind are at their strongest point together. The key concept being together. If your mind works and your body doesn't, or vice versa, it's game over. I vowed to myself that I would retire from the NHL before that happened. But I have to make the NHL before I can retire. Our training camp roster is split into four teams. Two teams practice together, and then we go into our respective locker rooms. The rink guys do a clean of the ice, and we come out and play each other. My mind is totally switched on to go full tilt. And my intense summer workouts mean that I am in game shape as we play these intra-squad mini-games up until the day of reckoning, which is 96 hours from now. It's like my entire life has converged on this day. If I screw it up, if I get injured and need a long rehab, if I piss off the wrong person on the wing's management, my dream is done. I'm not exaggerating. I've been a hockey player for 3/4 of my life. What else am I going to do? So I tell myself that the only way I can fail is if they beat me at my game, and I will not let them beat me. I'm glad the hotel has such a full breakfast menu because today I need the fuel. I have eggs, bacon, hash browns, and toast. I'm going to hit the ice at full speed. Though I'm sure that a veteran guy like the Wings right winger Darren McCarty rolled out of bed at maybe 7:45 a.m. to catch the 8 o'clock bus to the rink, and he probably downed a power bar for breakfast. I have my eye on McCarty because he's the kind of player I want to model my game after. Mac was a guy who walked with the swagger of a 1970s drug dealer from one of those old TV cop shows, like Starsky and Hutch. And he dressed like it was the 70s as well, with bling and plaid and more noise than style. Sure, he was a second-round pick who's been a Red Wing since 1993. But he plays what they call a gritty game. He hits, he fights, he can score. And so do I. My strategy was to go sandpaper to sandpaper against Mac. And he's in my practice group, so I have a feeling I'll get to show the bosses how I stack up. As a veteran, McCarty was here just to get through camp and get on with the season. He's got nothing to prove. Also, remember all those unwritten rules? One of them stipulates that rookies, and especially undrafted rookies, don't mess with veterans in camp. Now, I don't want to say that I took a run at Darren McCarty in that first scrimmage, but I definitely finished my check on him. He didn't go down. He's bigger than me, 6'1 and 215 pounds, but he certainly noticed. No one had hit him like that in training camp in years. I was making a statement that I would and could play with anyone. No one was off limits. Mac came back at me with some pushing and shoving. I know now that he wouldn't have fought me. The real danger was that he would have just smashed his stick over my head. He was smart enough to send a rookie a message without breaking his hand. So McCarty figured out who I was pretty early because I knocked on his door, so to speak. I remember after the scrimmage that my pal Chris Draper talked to me about it in the locker room. He was very close to Mac and played on the grind line with him and Kirk Maltby. On any other team, they'd have been the top line. Now Drapes was chuckling with me and at me. You really picked the right guy to go after. You're gonna wake up that sleeping bear and you better be ready. I was ready. I wasn't so stupid and reckless to think that if I went after a guy like Mac, I wouldn't need to keep my head up. And I wasn't going after him because I thought he'd never have any interest in mixing it up with me. I was just trying to get a job in the NHL. Mac wasn't going to let that go and got me back. He'd make me fill up his water bottle with Gatorade during practice, or ask me to go start his car after it. At training camp the following season, he took a run at me. I understood why he was doing it, and it never affected me. It was all part of the game. And if Darren McCarty held a grudge against me for the next 10 years because of the way I played against him that day back in September 2001, I don't blame him. But I wouldn't change a thing, because it worked. Chapter 2, Cincinnati Kid. On October 12, 2001, I was sent back to Cincinnati. I think now that the Red Wings initially had no plans for me to be on their team. But I changed that at training camp. And now they had to do the math and work me in. So getting sent down was part of the numbers game that is professional sports. There are more than a few guys who coulda, shoulda made it, but the math just didn't work out. I went back to the Cincinnati Mighty Ducks full of confidence. I'd proven that I could play in the NHL. And I'd also made $40,000, which was almost as much as I'd made all year in the AHL, where my salary was $48,500. Usually it was the assistant GM who delivered the news that a guy was going down. But Kenny Holland, the Wings GM, did it himself because he wanted to assure me that this Cincinnati assignment was temporary. I would be back with the big club soon, he said, and I believed him. The Cincinnati Mighty Ducks are an oddity. Half the guys on it are Anaheim prospects, hence the team name. The other half are Detroit guys. Not a lot of teams were splitting farm teams in those days, and it definitely affected chemistry. If a guy scored and he was in the Anaheim organization and you were a Red Wing, it didn't fire you up as much as if he was a Detroit player. You could also see the difference in the directions of the teams. Anaheim had a lot of Russians in Cincinnati, while Detroit left their Europeans at home and put the North American kids on the farm team. Detroit was smarter than everyone else, and didn't buy into the theory that Europeans had to learn the grittier NHL game in the minors. There are 23 guys on the team, and 20 of us are under the age of 22. We all live in the same apartment complex, and my roommate is Jan Wikström from Luleå, Sweden. He's a giant, a 6'5" defenseman who can actually skate. He's also a great guy. He can party like a Hall of Famer, and he's single. So he likes talking to the ladies, and they like talking to him. Our routine is hard, hard living. You wake up, you practice, you work out, and by noon you've banged out 4 or 5 hours of work. Then you eat, nap, and go out, and pretty much be a college kid. Even though I had never been to college, except as the guest of some hockey-loving college girl. I have a girlfriend back in Canada. Her name is Sarah Schill, and she's a tall, athletic beauty from Kitchener, Ontario. Her brother Jonathan was my line mate in Kingston, a very talented player who just didn't have the desire to make the NHL. While I'm in the USA, Sarah is living with my parents, Al and Marlene, in Toronto. She's doing a physio degree at Ryerson, and with my schedule here, we practice all day, every day except Monday. We're on the bus Thursday for a road trip, then we're back Sunday. I don't get to see her much at all. We talk on the phone. Remember, kids, no FaceTime or Skype yet. And I miss her. But I can't do anything about that except quit and go home, and that's not in the cards. Sarah was my first love, really. But I'd never seen anything of the world, and I knew that I wanted to experience as much as I could, and that the NHL was my best shot at doing that. I was a guy from suburban Ontario who was good at hockey, who met a nice girl from a good family, and I was with her until the moment my life started to change. By that I mean that my aspirations started to change. I no longer just wanted to be a good NHL player. I wanted to live the good life. I wanted to take advantage of the world that being a professional athlete offered. And I don't mean by going on some kind of sexual rampage. I mean the distance from Sarah made me understand the DNA of a relationship. And as I was going forward as a pro, I realized that I wasn't the kind of guy to get married at 21 and settle down. My priority is to have the best NHL career I possibly can. And Sarah knew it too. Cincinnati is a rough town. A hard-drinking place with a pretty stark racial divide. It's right on the Kentucky border, so it's where the South begins. We'd go to the casinos in the Bluegrass State, and I'd see that segregation was alive and well in the USA, with black people and white people living on opposite sides of an invisible line. Cincinnati is a football town, not a hockey town. And we'd be lucky to see 2,500 fans in our arena, which could hold 11,000. Hardcore, slapshot-type fans. There were nice booster club ladies making us Rice Krispie squares for road trips. The college girls in Cincinnati didn't know who we were. But we were young white guys who had some money, and so they gave us the time of day or night. I didn't enjoy my stay there as much as some guys did, because I was focused on getting back to Detroit. The guys who enjoyed it too much remained AHL Mighty Ducks a lot longer than they would have liked. Chris O'Sullivan was one of those AHL lifers. He had elite-level skill and could have easily been an NHL defenseman if he had wanted to be one. I mean, he played some in the NHL, but he was pulling down $250,000 a year in the minors playing hockey and having a good time. Not exactly a life of misery. Chris was a great guy, and good for him. But that wasn't the life for me. There is one very good thing about Cincinnati, and that is our coach, Mike Babcock. No one knew then that he would go on to be a superstar in his own right, winning Stanley Cups and World Cups and Olympic gold medals. We just knew he was a no-nonsense Saskatchewan boy who could play the game well enough to know his way around the minors. Babcock is not a giant, 6 feet, about 220 pounds, but he has a gigantic presence. And during my time in Cincinnati, he was like a lunatic compared to what any of us had been used to. I had never seen a coach like him before, had never seen players respond to or fear a coach like they did Babs. We were mesmerized by him as a group, because while his professional hockey resume wasn't anything to humble us, his coaching ascent was incredible. I don't think anyone has risen so fast to the top as Babs did. And that's because he knew what he wanted, and he had the talent to get it out of his players. He was focused on bringing it every single day. And he was as hard as he wanted to be on us, because he was just as hard on himself. He was being judged not just on his coaching, but on his development of us, on making sure that the big club's investment in us would pay off. I really liked him, and saw my time in Cincinnati as kind of a blessing. Mike Babcock was a great teacher. We listened to him, even if we didn't always understand him. He'd speak of tracking through the middle and we'd be scratching our heads. Then he'd explain. Think of yourselves as a laser beaming in on the puck. You attack it and steal it back, like a thief. The possession game was his baby, and he made you see it in your mind's eye so you could do it on the ice. He wasn't trying to teach us to be like Gretzky. He was trying to teach us to see the game like Gretzky saw it. He walked us through visualizing the whole game before we played it. He was brilliant. Babs was also a kind of pioneer, since he was at the beginning of the wave of young coaches coming from the American League to the NHL. Before that, NHL teams who had fired their coach and needed another one would just recycle some old crony they'd played with back in the days of black and white TVs. And the reason players feared Babs was that he coached us all on level ice. By that I mean he didn't care if you were a first round pick or not drafted at all. What he cared about was how serious you were about being the best that you could be. And if you dogged it, he'd bury you deep in the minors. He was coaching to win. I think Babcock took his AHL responsibilities more seriously than any other AHL coach did. He was thinking big things. Of course, I wasn't thinking that he'd be a great NHL coach someday because I didn't know what a great NHL coach was at that point. But I was going to learn soon enough. One day after practice in Cincinnati, as I'm heading off the ice sweaty and exhausted, Mike Babcock pulls me aside. "You're going back to Detroit, Aves," he says, as if this is a regular thing. I found Bab's timing hilarious. As he ground me through an AHL practice first, when clearly he already knew I was going up to the NHL, he was putting his stamp on the product that he was sending up to the big leagues. He was trying to make me a better player, and also to protect his own reputation. That's classic Babs. All I knew at that moment was that I was going back up to where I believed I belonged, and was never planning on coming back to Cincinnati. Chapter 3, Showtime. It's December 19th, 2001 when I make my NHL debut. 16 years after I first decided I would be an NHL player, I am pulling on Detroit's famous jersey and skating out as part of the team for a home game against Vancouver. So you might think that I'm floating on the pure joy of having made my goal. Well, yes and no. I felt excitement, to be sure. But I would describe it as controlled nerves. I knew I didn't need to put all my hopes and dreams into the first game, because that was way too much pressure. I needed to stay focused, to do something that made sure Detroit wouldn't send me back to Cincinnati. I think most guys embrace that first NHL game as if it's the end of the journey. Now I can die happy kind of thing. I didn't have that mentality because I had no plans to die. And to be honest, I don't even know that any accomplishment would have kept me happy for long. The lights were brighter because the game was on TV. The rink was immaculate. And the jerseys and our gear were perfectly laid out as though we were in some kind of magic temple. It was like arriving in hockey utopia. I needed to throw everything out there. No feeling it out. No playing a little bit nervous. No staring awestruck into the stands thinking, "Hey there, Detroit fans. You who have seen more Hall of Famers than I have seen years. Look at me. I am an NHLer." Nope. I played my first game in the NHL just like I played my 200th. Okay. Maybe once in the warm-up I let myself think how cool this is that I'm finally here. But then it was back to the job at hand. Now that I'm here, I'm staying. My NHL debut is also made not so much easier, but more comfortable because I know many of the guys on the team from my previous training camps with the Wings. Hull, Yzerman, Chelios, and Shanahan are like my wicked uncles and start grinding on me right away. They joked that Scotty Bowman talked me up before I arrived, saying, "We've got this guy who scored 30 goals in Pee Wee, and he's going to add something to the lineup." And I laughed too. I would have laughed at anything. Because Brett Hull was my teammate. I was sitting in the dressing room with a guy who I'd previously only seen on a poster on my bedroom wall. Of course, Scotty never said a word to me before my first game. But the fact that all these Hall of Famers were hearing about me before my debut seemed like a pretty good sign. I would come to learn that Scotty would talk crazy like that. But it was never because he liked to hear himself speak. Scotty, who fractured his skull when he got whacked in the head while playing junior, it ended his hockey career, always looked as if he were communing with invisible forces. His gaze shifting from you to the superior intelligence of the aliens he was exploring hockey strategies with. Part of it was the head injury. Part of it was the radio waves from the mothership. There were a lot of guys they could have brought up or traded for at that point in the season to a team with 9 future Hall of Famers on it. And so, the fact that they chose me told me that the Red Wings brain trust, and it was a brain trust, with Kenny Holland and Jim Devolano and Scotty Bowman, 3 of the smartest guys I've ever met, thought I was one of those chemicals in the Red Wings potion that could keep the magic going. Jimmy D also created a very strong support system for the big team. He would identify the young prospects and then come down to Cincinnati a few times a year to see us. He also talked to us in training camp. He would take us out for breakfast before the morning skate, and the conversation would be aimed more at finding out what makes this kid tick than what kind of skates I liked. "What do you like to do away from the game?" he'd ask me. "Prepare for the next one," is what I told him. There is really no point in being completely honest with management. I think Devolano was ultimately the decision maker on whether a certain player was going to fit into the organization's big plan. Whether the player was going to represent the team and fall into line with what they were doing. I would also learn with gratitude that while Jimmy D didn't tolerate fools, he believed in second chances. The Red Wings would give me more than a few. And now they were giving me my big chance. It wasn't like they were desperate. We were at the top of the NHL at this point in the season with 65 points, though on a bit of a slide. In the 10 games before I'm called up, the Wings have 3 wins, 2 ties, and 5 losses. You don't get to be a dynasty with lazy thinking. And Scotty Bowman was not only a great thinker, but a great psychologist. He could read people and situations and use the data however he needed to use it. He must have felt a crash coming, and so he brought me up. One of the best things about my first NHL game was that my parents, Al and Marlene, got to be there. For years, they'd hauled me all over the country to pursue my hockey dreams. But we didn't have any kind of Hallmark conversation about how great it was to be playing my first NHL game. I know that they were nervous too, though. I mean, I'm still their little boy who they suffered with when I was told I'd never make it, and encouraged when I said that I would. Never ever did they doubt me. So they know how much this means. Nothing to be said, really, until it's done. I had 17 shifts and 10 minutes of ice time in that first game, which was just fine with me. I could have had 1 shift, and I would have been happy. While I didn't score, hell, I didn't even get a shot on net. I knew when it was over that I could play in the NHL, and we beat Vancouver 4-1. After the game, I met up with my parents, who definitely played it cool, even though I know they were pretty pumped up. They were feeling my mood, and my mood after the game was that I wanted to play another one. But I was concerned about whether I would get the chance. I could be sent down, depending on what plans the Wizard Bowman had up his sleeve. But I was not sent down. And with me in the lineup, the Wings had 7 wins, 1 tie, and 1 loss before we met Vancouver again. It was in this game that I think I showed the Red Wings just what I could do for the team in the run to the playoffs. We were losing 3-0 to Vancouver before the first period was out. So with just over a minute left in the period, Scotty puts me out on the ice. Why does Bowman send out a guy like me? He doesn't have to tell me. He just taps me on the shoulder. The Canucks captain, Trevor Linden, is also out there. I had no plans to fight Linden before that game. I mean, I was way too nervous. Hockey fights may look like good, clean fun, but trust me, picking a fight with an elite athlete is not for the faint of heart. Later in my career, I would look at the schedule in September and know who I was going to be fighting in a game in February. But not that night. And no one really ever planned to fight Trevor Linden anyway. I had followed him as a kid and thought of him as Captain Canada, even though I didn't model myself after him or his game. Telly thought he was soft. But Linden had been chosen second overall in the 1988 NHL entry draft and had quickly become the darling of the Canucks and their fans. He was a great member of the Vancouver community, doing charity stuff and being nice to kids and old ladies and dogs. The guy even had dimples. That was the perfect climate for me to strike. I must have rubbed every single player on Vancouver the wrong way during that first period. This is exactly the kind of thing I was good at in junior, and it was working here. I was a motor mouth from the minute the game started. I was yapping at everybody, from the bench, on the ice. I definitely did research before the game. I mean, I was a fan of the NHL. I knew who I was playing against. For instance, the Canucks had Matt Cook in their lineup, and I had played against him in junior. He was the same chicken shit player in the NHL as he was in junior, and I was all over him. "You have seriously bad shit running in your blood," is what I kept yelling at Cook, because I did think the guy was more than an agitator. I thought he was downright dirty. See what I mean about unwritten rules? I have my own. I remember the Canucks' Ed Jovanovski laughing about me with Kurt Malpe after a whistle, as in, "Where the fuck did you find this kid Avery?" Most fans think that opposing NHLers are at war from the anthem to the final buzzer. And I guess it's true that there's pretty much no one you wouldn't run over if you caught him with his head down. There's a whole list of guys who've dropped the gloves with their own brothers. But the guys all know each other from junior or from playing together over the years. When we're yapping at each other on the ice, it's not always trash talking. I've heard everything on the ice from guys doing deals to buy boats off each other, to asking if they could get the hot cousin's phone number, or planning to meet up for a drink after the game at a peeler bar if the visiting team travel schedule allows. But I was not inviting Linden out for a beer. I took a run at him and whacked him a few times. Linden, as captain, decides to put me in my place. Now, this is almost unheard of. The team captain fighting a rookie like me? Veterans actually consider it a favor to the younger guy to do him the honor of punching him in the face. I'm serious. But the captain sets the tone for the team. I guess Linden thought the Canucks had heard enough from me. But I was actually surprised when he dropped the gloves. He caught me off guard at first, and I had to scramble to get traction in this tilt. Linden may seem to be a bit of a choir boy, but he's 6'4", and when he gets a fistful of my sweater and starts in on me, I know I'm in a real fight. We went back and forth pretty good, and then when he missed with a right, his momentum pitched him forward and I yanked him down and threw another right for good measure. The fight ended with Linden on the ice and me being hauled away by the linesman, and the Detroit fans in the Joe Louis Arena cheering as if I was the Brown Bomber himself. The Fox Sports guys calling the game said this was exactly what the Wings needed and that Sean Avery knew that. They were right, because my fight with Linden woke us all up. Chelios, Shanahan, Hull, and Yzerman are all slapping me on the back and yelling at the team to follow my lead and take it up a level. And we won that game 4-3 in overtime. I didn't put the puck in the net, but I have no doubt that my 6 minutes and 11 seconds of ice time made a difference. I could only hope that Scotty Bowman and Ken Holland were saying that this kid has something that most don't. I stayed with the Wings for a month, but I had been called up because of injuries to other guys. A dirty little secret of professional sports is that guys in the minors don't mind when guys on the big team get hurt, because it means we get a chance. And then kaboom. I got sent down again to Cincinnati because Igor Larionov and Darren McCarty came back, and there wasn't much I could do about that. To be honest, I wouldn't have been unhappy if McCarty had been hurt for the entire season. Not to wish him ill, but so I could have cemented my spot on the grind line with Drapes and Malpe. You do your best, and you're even good enough to stay up with the big club, but the math and the medics get in your way when a guy comes back from injury. It was a punch in the gut to get sent down. But I returned to the Wings for the last 3 months of the 2001-2002 season, and by the way, we won the Stanley Cup. I would not be sent down again. By March 2002, I've been with the team for 3 months, and I'm getting comfortable with the rhythms of the big time. Everything taken care of, from the best coaching and equipment to player maintenance, to pregame and postgame meals, to luxurious charter flights and swank hotels. I am still this kid from Scarborough, Ontario, who has to pinch himself to make sure it's not a dream. On any given day, you would walk into the dressing room and a Red Wing legend like Ted Lindsay would be working out. I'd ride the bike beside Lindsay for half an hour and then spot him on the bench press. He had to have been 75 years old then, but he was in great shape. The traditional rules that were part of other organizations, rules saying that nobody could hang around the team at any point and that the dressing room was off limits, were not in play in Hockey Town. Detroit was an organization that understood what it really took to win. Scotty Bowman and Steve Yzerman weren't concerned on any level that terrible Ted Lindsay was in the weight room on the day of a game. It wasn't even a question, because they knew it wasn't going to make a difference in how we played. As a player, I was starting to understand what the league was about, as taught to me by the Red Wings. When you've played in Detroit and you move on to other places, you have to bury your knowledge deep. Because when you see the bullshit these other organizations pretend to worry about and how petty it becomes, you know a good team doesn't care about stuff like that. Because you've been on one and seen it work. On March 2nd, 2002, a Saturday afternoon game in Pittsburgh that was being beamed out to millions on NBC, we were leading 2-1 with 5 minutes on the clock. In a situation like that, every bounce seems to go to the other team. But this one went my way. The Penguins were trying to carry the puck out of their zone when we came in hard on the forecheck. Three of us on two Penguins. And Thomas Holmstrom digs the puck out from a scrum. It pops onto my stick, just about even with the dot in the faceoff circle to the goalie's right. And I take a couple of strides, but my shooting angle is one for magicians, because now I'm on the goal line. Even so, the mantra that you can't score if you don't shoot has been drilled into my head since I was a little kid. So I shoot from the goal line, about 15 feet to the right of the Penguins goalie, Jean-Sebastien Aubin. And amazingly, he's drifting away to his left, assuming that I'm going to pass. And the puck hits him and bounces in the net. I have my first NHL goal. I celebrate it like I'm 8 years old, because I've imagined this moment since I was 8 years old and played my first hockey game. It's not a meaningless goal either, as it puts the game into the safe zone for us. And it gives me street cred with fans in Canada and the USA who are watching and who maybe now think that, yes, Sean Avery can play in the NHL. And yes, we pay attention to fans. Not only in the arena, but those watching on TV.